I am so excited to announce my newest baby, a book for parents all about tongue tie. Tongue Tie for Parents is the book you need if you have any questions about whether there's a tongue tie, how to get treatment, if your baby needs treatment, how to go about it, how to make decisions, how to help you and your baby recover. All of that is in this ebook. Every day I get questions from parents like you, and I know you need answers. Tongue Tie for Parents is built from the same step-by-step protocol I use when families sit across from me in my office. It's the information that you need for clarity, for confidence, and to help you make care decisions based on your own goals, because that's what's most important. You shouldn't need a Google search to get answers. You aren't crazy or overreacting. You are trying to figure out what is best for you and your baby. It's here and ready for you. Tongue Tie for Parents is an easy download. You can have it today for only $27. Go to tonguetieexperts.net/parentbook or follow the link in the show notes, because you and your baby deserve clarity, not confusion. You're listening to the Tongue Tie Experts Podcast, a weekly program providing information and support for those families impacted by tongue and lip tie and the professionals caring for them. I'm Lisa Palladino, a midwife and a lactation consultant with over 30 years of experience. If you are a parent looking for answers or a professional who is curious to learn more than what you learned in school on this topic, welcome. This podcast is for you. Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the Tongue Tie Experts Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Lisa Palladino. And today I am really happy to finally have Dr. Martin Kaplan as a guest. I've been trying to get Dr. Kaplan for a while now, and I finally narrowed him down to a time, and here we are. So Dr. Martin Kaplan is a pioneer in pediatric laser dentistry with over 45 years of experience. Dr. Kaplan was the first dentist in the U.S. to perform infant frenum laser procedures using the light scalpel in 2013. He later became the first pediatric dental specialist to earn diplomat status with the American Board of Laser Surgery, where he now serves as Director of Dental Laser Surgery. A longtime educator, Dr. Kaplan has taught at Tufts University, co-authored numerous dental texts, and helped develop one of the first comprehensive infant laser phrenotomy courses in the U.S., now taught across North America and Australia. He collaborates closely with lactation consultants, SLPs, body workers, and feeding teams to address oral function issues at all ages. In 2020, he received the prestigious Kumar Patel Laser Education Award for his dedication to evidence-based laser surgery education. Outside the clinic, Dr. Kaplan is a fifth-degree black belt in Kenpo Karate and a ballroom dancer who has won numerous awards. Welcome, Dr. Kaplan. It's a pleasure to have you here today.
Thanks. It's been a long time coming, but I'm looking forward to this. This
will be fun. So one of the things that, you know, a couple of things popped out at me in your history. First of all, I know you're an educator because that's how we met. I think we met in New Jersey at one of the early American Laser Study Club interdisciplinary laser and practitioner, small group educations, right? That's right. I think that was the first time we met a few years ago. And I knew that, but I did not know that you were the first to use light scalpel. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, thanks. I was a member originally of the Academy of Laser Dentistry for a short time. And while I was there, I came across the light scalpel with, Peter Vitrick from, in Washington State. And the way we were educated at the time for the use of lasers, I always had a little bit of an issue with the fact that everybody's using diodes, and diodes, you have to touch tissue, and it has to heat up, and you got to wait a while before there's a response with time. And this the light scalpel was an instant application of tissue response to the babies. It would take me anywhere from like 3 to 5 or 6 seconds to get a tongue-tie procedure done, where the diode lasers would take, 30 seconds or a little longer, sometimes less or more, but this was a lot safer. And what I also learned, as I was studying for the American Board of Laser Surgery and a few other things before I became a member of, the American Laser Study Club, this laser just pulses down and it hits the tissue in 50 micron pokes into the tissue. And each one of these little pokes of the tissue is 50 microns, which is a third of the thickness of a human hair. And it pulses really quickly, 30 milliseconds per pulse, which I know is, I'm getting kind of technical, but if you think you can't count 1,000 in a second, and this is 30 milliseconds. Where the other laser, you have to touch tissue, and there's the delay time, and the heat of the tissue, which is up to 1,000 degrees Celsius, heats into the tissue to about a millimeter versus, a third of the thickness of a human hair. So once I came across this and realized what was going on, then I started to become more involved with light scalpel. And then Peter offered to have me try the light scalpel in my office. And I was a little anxious the first day when we were using it, but, I tried it out. And since then, I never picked up another laser to do soft tissue surgery on anybody.
First of all, I want to thank you for being brave to try the new thing, because that doesn't happen often, right? That opportunity, and that must have been a little bit nerve-wracking, anxiety-producing. You have this new thing and you're going to try it on a human,
Yeah.
But I also, for those who don't know about lasers, because I have, you may be a parent listening to this podcast or a professional who hasn't learned a lot about laser technology, I highly recommend attending one of Dr. Vitrick's lectures all about how the physics of the laser, because the first time I heard that, I was fascinated. And every time I hear him do that exact, almost the exact same lecture, I learn something new. It's technical, but it's important to understand that a laser is not a laser. There are different types, and there's different types of lasers that are good for different applications, right? In dentistry and skin and in all the ways we use lasers. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you from what I have seen of diode releases versus CO2 laser, which the light scalpel is, there's no difference. I've seen babies that look like they had their mouth burned from the diode laser. Well, which is, I don't mean that mouths were burned. I mean, the tissue looks more charred. I have to be gentle with the way I say things.
Yeah.
No. So not to make this a commercial for light scalpel, but that's why we back up what we do, not because of the affiliation, but because we believe in a certain way of doing things, right?
Well, if I can add one thing, first of all, you have to be, I don't really care what somebody uses. If they're limited to what they can use for treatment, that's fine. But they have to know the limitations of the instrument they're using versus a diode or the other carbon dioxide lasers, or there's even erbiums out there. But a laser is not a laser. Like you said, when I explained to the parents the differences with some of these things, because everybody assumes a laser is just going to do the same for all the tissue and there's never going to be any bleeding and all this other stuff going on. And you have to rub on the tissue versus the side of the tissue. What I tell the parents, as I was just saying before, is if you think of 30 milliseconds per pulse and going down that shallow, think of it similar to somebody having LASIK eye surgery. So they're using a laser on your eye, and they're recontouring the lens of your eye. But if you're using a diode laser on your eye, you'd be burning it and you'd be blind. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge difference in the way the tissue works. So not all lasers, like you said, are the same. There's different types. But skill set's important too. You could have the best laser in the world. If you don't know what you're doing, then you get into trouble. And right, when people get into trouble too, especially I think on the internet, though, the internet will you know, people rely on for backup. Parents will ask, well, what does this look like and what does this look like? And it doesn't have to necessarily be an exact diamond or triangle of a certain depth, and people don't realize there's anatomy you have to consider too, and there's, you know, body mechanics and access to tissue, and there's sometimes a blood vessel could be in the way and you just have to stop so it doesn't all have to look the same.
Right. I think what you're referring to is when people post pictures and say, I had my baby's tongue tie released. Does this look right? And You can't tell that from a picture. The same way you can't assess a tongue tie restriction from a picture because it's a functional assessment. It's functional, right? If it may look terrible, but if it works, it's okay.
Yeah. You know, and everybody's tissue is different. You know, in some of the lectures that we're at too, we talk about different types of tissues. There's thick, there's thin, there's what we're calling like a flow and a berg. Excuse me. If you think of like a flow tissue, would be like a thin sheet of ice, or think of the thin membrane on a chicken breast versus something that's a berg. Think of like a grizzly steak or something thick like that. So the tissue responds differently, and you have to know what's what. And that's where when you're doing the treatment, if you know what you're doing with this, you can even reinforce. You have to see a body worker. Because the body worker, like a, you know, a cranial sacral therapist or a chiropractor, will help in addition to finding if the tissue can respond better even after a procedure. It's not always one and done like many people think. Many times it is one and done, but not everybody has access to body workers and a properly trained IBCLC. And then there's finances. Sometimes there's even language barriers. You know, I get a lot of referrals indirectly from Brazil, where I'm seeing a lot of Portuguese patients, and there's very few Portuguese-speaking lactation consultants and very few pediatricians that understand Portuguese, and you got to use an interpreter for this, and it makes it hard. Sometimes just doing some treatment will be better than doing nothing.
Mm-hmm. So that's a good point, and we started chatting about that a little bit before we signed on, about how... You know, there is no ideal way to treat every client, or there is an ideal way that we wish everybody could have. Yeah. But then each client comes to us or comes to whatever entry point as an individual with specific needs, with specific access, with specific finances, and specific problems, right? So we have to meet them where they are. You know, I didn't mention that you are in practice in Boston, right? I mean, I think we're hearing where you're from your accent. I still sound very New York. You're very Boston, right?
But I did grad school in New York, so I'm okay.
Okay. So, now in New Jersey, but that's not too much different because most of the people that I live around are all from New York.
Yeah.
So, let's talk a little bit about that access to care and absolutes in our protocols. You know, of course, I teach in my professional's guide and my parent's guide ideal protocols, but we're not an ideal. When a patient is in front of us, they are a patient, an individual, a family. We have to meet them where they are. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, a lot of times I have referrals come into me, and it's word of mouth because I've been around for a while. Excuse me. And especially like, you know, I've had a lot of, Portuguese and Spanish people coming in because of referrals because they know I treat a lot of them. And then a lot, not everybody, but I also have a whole group of patients that are on mass public assistance. And I do treat people on mass assistance. And there's not always access for these people who have this limitation in their insurance to have, let's say, chiropractic, body work, or even IBCLC support, because then the pediatricians aren't supporting them a lot too. So there's a time where you sometimes have to do treatment in spite of people not having all that they need. Mm-hmm. But when I'm doing my initial intake, I want the mother's history, I want a birthing history, I want to know whether it was a C-section, vaginal, any problems at all. Then I want to know, you know, whether there was a diagnosis and why or why they didn't do treatment, then get all the baby symptoms, and you can see what's going on from there. And, you know, and then a lot of the parents think it's only related to breastfeeding. And I say, no, it's not just breastfeeding. It's bottle feeding is fine, too. Not everybody wants to breastfeed. And I have a lot of parents that I've seen that are foster parents because the kids have been born to substance abuse parents. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot to take into account.
Right. And I've seen your history because when you teach, your intake forms, which is pretty impressive. It's one of the biggest, I mean, I thought my intake forms were holistic. You really are holistic, considering that you're a dentist and asking about birth history. And I appreciate and respect the fact that you understand how all of this interplays. Not every dentist gets that yet, but it's important to look at all the aspects of everything. And I think that what we're getting to is, there are some people who say never release without body work. And there are some people who say a dentist who does will get a bad rap if they haven't seen an IBCLC. But we have, you know, again, not everybody is going to have that ideal setup. We have to do the best for that person in front of us and what they can afford, what they have the bandwidth to do, and what that baby needs. And the other thing is, nobody's coming to you because they don't have a problem. They recognize there's a problem. That's why they're coming to you. Right? Yeah. It's not like you're searching them out on the street and saying, let me do the tongue tie. And then there's no symptoms.
Some people come in and they'll want to know why I won't treat them, because sometimes it's not the tongue tie. Like you're saying, holistically looking, you can see if somebody has, let's say, torticollis, and you know they're off to the side, but you don't see anything as far as a tie goes. Although many times I see a lot of kids that have a diagnosis of torticollis, or they've been recommended helmet therapy because of skeletal asymmetry, but they have ties. And the anatomy of the ties relate to a lot of other anatomy. Like, you know, the tongue attaches to the hyoid bone, and then from the hyoid bone, there are other muscles underneath in the neck. I know we're getting kind of technical, but it pulls the shoulder up. And then the head will be off to the side. You can do all the release you want. If the child still can't move because something else is going on, you have to get some additional therapy. And some torticollises don't go away at all because they actually have a tie, and that's missed.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, not only what I have found, not only in my private practice, but in my personal life, is the burden of treatment for a family, even if it's not a financial burden, just the burden of the appointment load, the stress, you know, early postpartum, you know, what's going on with the family with other kids, needing to get to appointments. You know, I mean, I was, and I hope she doesn't mind I say this, I was just talking to my daughter who was saying her baby, she's got a 2-month-old who had a release, who had all the therapies in the beginning, and now the latch is bothering her again. And I said, well, you know what you have to do? You have to go back to, and I told her who to go to that she had seen previously, an OT who does CST and tummy time method. And she said, Mom, I don't have time for that. Right? So that's our own family. So, you know, like, let's be real here. There is, and I don't blame her, right? I don't blame her. It's easy for us to sit here and say, you should do this and you should do that. But we have to realize, you know, she's got stuff going on with her toddler, and she's got whatever work burden and this and that and the other thing going on. She will get to it, but it's not, it's easier for us to see the importance of it and the urgency of it than our patients sometimes.
Right.
If you support families with infant feeding, as a lactation consultant, SLP, therapist, doula, or other provider, you won't want to miss this. I'm Lisa Palladino, certified nurse midwife and IBCLC, and I'd love to invite you to my free 3-day video training, Why Tongue Tie is Missed and How You Can Learn to Spot It with Confidence. In just a few short videos, you'll gain the clarity you've been craving around tongue tie, what to look for, why it's often missed, and how you can better support the families in your care. It's free, flexible, and made for busy professionals like you. Sign up now at tonguetieexperts.kit.com/free. That's tonguetieexperts.kit.com/free. The clickable link will be in the show notes. I'll see you there.
Well, if I can add one thing, I'll have some people call up occasionally, or I'll see something on the internet where someone's showing a picture of their child and say, oh, it doesn't look like this was done well enough, or it wasn't mm-hmm. deep enough, or something's wrong. But they don't know whether the person, like I'll be treating a hemophiliac pretty soon. You don't know what the hemophiliac does. You have to stop at certain points in time. Mm-hmm. I had a couple of kids that had strokes recently that were on baby mm-hmm. aspirin too. And then, you know, the tissue response is going to be a little bit different. But then you got to think holistically, is this child sleeping better? Are they not moving in their sleep as much anymore? Do they have more head rotation? Can they do tummy time where before they couldn't? And maybe they're mm-hmm. less gassy. And they could also have cow's milk protein intolerance, and they do need a diet change and things. There's a lot of different stuff that occurs. And if people can't have time for the, like you said, with your daughter, maybe that's part of the issue. Maybe she doesn't have time to do all the exercise and the baby relapsed a little bit. But other symptoms may be better besides just the latch being off a little bit. Right, that's where it right. becomes complicated.
There's definitely, yeah.
We all have to work together and listen.
Yeah, yeah. So, but I also... I like to look at the report of symptoms as a clue as to sliding back, right? Like that's mm-hmm. how I feel I define in my practice and in my protocols. Reattachment isn't what it looks like. It's a reoccurrence of the symptoms that caused us to have the release, right?
Yeah.
So her reflux is a little better. She's not hurting all the time. She's a very efficient eater. She can... hold a pacifier in her mouth where before she wasn't so good at that, which not that I want her to have a pacifier just as a yeah. test, you know? Well, so there is improvement. She's a good baby.
I was going to say one thing, because since you mentioned pacifier, a lot of people I find have missed the fact that the kids go back to a certain pacifier, and which pacifier are they on? Because there's different shapes. There's like mm-hmm. a bibs, which is more like a light bulb. There's a nook that looks like a side of a lipstick that's, you know, never used. A mem that's more rectangular, and then there's a bibs one and a more circular one. And if someone has some treatment and they don't take away the pacifier, let's say like the nook one, it's going to push the tongue back where it was before. It's going to heal wrong.
Right.
And a lot of people don't think about that. And they got to actually look, oh, we just did the treatment. And then they go back to what they were doing before because it was convenient. Right. But you just changed the shape of the mouth, or the function of the mouth can be better. The tongue come out different. So let's say you got a lock and a key. You just changed the lock, but now you need a different key. And you want the mm-hmm. right size, which is better than all these other ones.
Right. And that lock can change to fit the key. We don't want the lock to fit the key of a small pointy pacifier, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, in the ideal world, we wouldn't use pacifiers at all, but
yeah,
sometimes
but a lot of
we
people
need
do.
Them, you
yeah.
know? So we want ones that make the baby have to work to keep it in. That's mm-hmm. my criteria.
Yeah.
I won't mention any names because I don't have any endorsements or anything, but there are some pacifiers that the baby has to work to keep in the mouth, and I like that. I like that better.
Yeah. And ideally, yeah, no pacifier is certainly the best. But, mm-hmm. you know, then as the baby's sleeping with their mouth open, what's their head position? You know, I'm asking right. all those questions too, which is important.
Right.
If the head was leaning back, also, you know, I hear a lot of stories, well, the baby doesn't have a high, narrow palate. If the head is arched backwards, they're going to have a shallower palate. If the head's down flexed, they're going to have a narrow palate. There's mm-hmm. a lot of different things. So you can't look at one particular thing like we were saying right. before. Holistically, it's important to look at everything.
Absolutely, yeah. And you don't only treat infants. You treat all ages, right?
Yeah, my youngest patient's 23 hours old, which shocked me because I looked at the intake form and I go, did you write the date down? And the mother goes, here's my ID bracelet from the hospital. You treated my other kids. I wanted to see you. So an 11-pound vaginally delivered baby came to me when she was 23 hours old. I was
wow.
shocked.
Wow.
But my oldest patient's 77, and she had less severe migraines, and she slept a little better right after that, even though she was 77.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole bunch of structural stuff that happens in the body, but a lot of the kids I'm seeing are 2, 3, and 4 that are having trouble with eating and sleeping and hyperactivity. And a lot of the early interventions are sending the kids to me now because they realize a lot of these kids have tongue and lip issues. And if they're poor sleepers, then the development gets off.
Right. So whether or not the multidisciplinary treatment happens, we do know for sure that there are some issues down the line that can be associated with tongue and lip tie. And that leads into the whole airway issue, which to me is the holy grail of all of this. This is all, even though we started talking about breastfeeding, and that's where, that was my entry level as an IBCLC, what's important is the airway.
Yeah.
And how do we get there? And how does breastfeeding teach us, is the airway working correctly, right?
Right. Well, you know, I'm seeing a lot of 1, 2, and 3-year-olds, and the parents would tell me, yeah, there was a tongue tie, but the pediatrician said they will outgrow it or it's not a big deal. But they were feeding the kids 24/7, and the other diagnosis was, well, they're gaining weight, don't worry about it. But meanwhile, the family's all stressed out from that. I know you've seen that a lot too.
Yeah.
But when the kids start coming in at 1, 2, and 3, and you start, you know, taking it other types of symptoms for your intake forms, along with asking birthing history, you see a lot of these things would be missed in the past. Although not everything is tongue, lip, and also buccal ties too. You know, you may just need some body work. There may have been a problem with, the kid was breech, and they said, well, he was breech, but his hips were okayed by the, by an x-ray exam, but they should be seeing somebody for soft tissue stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, everything's tied, no pun intended, into each other. So, yeah, I mean, I'm going to put you on the spot, but what do you think is the most, dramatic or, successful? Like, what would you say was like somebody who stands out to you that was able to verbalize to you how differently they felt after release?
I mean, an adult?
Yeah, an adult, an older child.
Well, the older child, like once I finished with one of the kids recently, they turned around and looked at me and says, wow, I can turn my head and move my head differently because the hyoid was loosened up. I have
immediately.
That's
incredible.
Yeah. And another girl I saw in a follow-up, and this was years ago, her head was always off to the side. It looked like she was a torticollis baby that was missed for years, and she had something that they said was Duane syndrome. And I don't think it was really that, but after I saw her a few weeks later, she said, I could ask you a question. I go, what? She says, I'm playing better in soccer. I can kick the ball better. Do you think it's because I can stand straighter? Her head was straighter, and so her body was better, and her vision wasn't off. So there's a lot of stuff. Even the parents, if you think about a baby, they'll say the baby prefers one side of breastfeeding or being held a certain way for a bottle. After that, they can move their head, and they can even do tummy time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that over and over again. And you know what's interesting? Sometimes we don't realize the improvement because we have like a negativity bias against things that get better. Mm-hmm. So I always like to ask, and this is something, if you're a provider taking care of anybody, make a list of the symptoms they had and go through them at each, if there's a return visit. Like, so for example, for me, I'll say right before we have the procedure or when I'm releasing the parent to go get their evaluation by the dentist, I'll say, let's make a list of the symptoms that are causing us to go get evaluated. So whether that be reflux or difficulty with tummy time or crying in the car seat or, never seeming satisfied or all the things, gassy or explosive bowel movements. There's a whole list. Go through the list, check off the ones that pertain to this parent. And then afterwards, when they come back, I'll say, well, let's talk about these symptoms and go through them. And then they realize how much improvement they have. If I just like blankly said, do you think this helped? They'll say, yeah, a little bit. And then we go down the list and they're like, oh yeah. I had this one couple I'll never forget when they were saying, we're not sure if we should have had this done because there was something that was still going on. And I said, well, let's talk about the symptoms. Is the baby still having reflux? And the mom said, no, she doesn't throw up anymore at all. I said, well, there's the improvement, right? They hadn't even thought about it. So sometimes in the, I do this with my wellness patients too. I like make a numbered symptom questionnaire so they can see how they're progressing because we don't realize when we're better. We only realize when things are worse.
Right.
So yeah, that's interesting.
One thing I see in a lot of the kids too, after we have treatment, you get that little guppy exercise where you hold the kids' hands and you let them see if they're doing pull-ups, like they come up one piece like a 2x4, they're kind of flexible.
Well, the kids have head lag, you're talking about.
Some don't have head lag, they're just stiff. Right. They get fists and their knees are up all the time too when you're doing the exam. Then after you do the treatment and you give the child to the parent, the kid acts like a slinky in your hand because you've loosened everything up on them. And then they'll say, wow, look, his mouth looks so much bigger. You know, because everything was tight and now it's loosened up. And I usually joke with them about sometimes the kid's forehead's a little bit scrunched and their eyebrows are up because they're tight. And they say, well, that was the Botox I just did as part of the procedure to loosen them up. But the whole body is much more relaxed and their hands are down and they're not fisting while they're either nursing or bottle feeding. And that's something that people miss. Like, it may look like, quote, it reattach, but the tissue is all loosened up and you change something.
And that's why in the ideal world, that body work before, after. I even have craniosacral therapists around me that are doing treatment during the release, you know, hands-on right before, during, and after, which is a beautiful, ideal way to treat. You know, you see those babies are so settled and calm afterwards because I know for myself, a CST treatment it works the same as a full body massage. It just, it's barely touch, but it just totally relaxes, you know, everything.
Well, you know, even some of the kids, when you're treating them, some kids sound like they're, well, are crying the entire time because they don't like laying flat when you're doing the exam. And then you sit them up and then they're quiet. Or some of the kids have been in the NICU or they've had a lot of medical procedures. You know, when you're doing the exam, the parents are very anxious. And I understand that because the kids are used to they're just being touched and uncomfortable all the time. After the procedure, they may be like that, but then they're more relaxed a day or two later. Right. And that's something you got to look, you got to have people understand too. And kids that, just one other thing while I'm thinking about it, I know I'm jumping all over the place, but kids that have come in that are like failure to thrive or else they have to eat an awful lot because they're spitting up a lot or they're falling asleep at the breast or the bottle. After you do the treatment, they may be tired after the treatment too and be, let's say, exhausted for a half hour to an hour and you can't do all the post-op stuff you want. But I explained that to them too, especially like I said, the failure to thrive kids, they may be wiped out afterwards. I tell the parents, think about it, like if you had the flu and you feel like you're fine, you walk around the house for a while, then you got to take a nap because you're exhausted.
Right.
So the kids can be like that too. So there's a lot of stuff. It's not just the tie.
Right. Especially those very young babies, because one of the states of baby, you know, neurologically is just to shut down to protect themselves. So that happens too. I see that a lot. And then I just want to talk about NICU for one second.
Oh, good. I was going to say something about that too. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, we have to realize that. And I've had babies who in my practice who I've delayed the procedure while they, you know, emotionally, while the mother and baby emotionally heal from that NICU experience, because that's traumatic. And we don't say that enough because we want to, you know, NICU save lives and we're supposed to just be all like everything positive about NICU. But there's a lot of negativity and a lot of things that happen to the baby and the mom and mom experiencing that need to be addressed, including a lot of oral stuff that is involuntarily happening in the baby's mouth without their permission, so to speak, you know?
Yeah. Well, what I was just going to say is last week I saw a baby that was born at 26 weeks, weighed 1 pound, 14.6 ounces, was in the NICU for 64 days, started out with a CPAP and an oral feeding tube, then went to a, you know, an NG tube, and then was eventually be able to bottle feed. And I saw her 3 months after all this was done. And there's still some things going on, but the baby was more or less ready to have some treatment because from the exam, I could tell there was strength going on. The mother, of course, was nervous, but I had to tell the mother I understood all the stuff she was going through and they were ready for treatment. I did treatment that day and the baby's doing a lot better because, you know, she was, instead of taking, let's say, an ounce in a short amount of time, she was able to do 4 ounces almost immediately.
Wow.
But the baby was stronger and the baby wasn't, you know, 26 weeks. She was, she was, you know, she got up to 64 days out of the NICU plus 3 months. So she was stronger and ready. You can't do things before the kids are ready.
Right, right. So isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Somebody born that small and, you know, and what what scares me is those kids who are failure to thrive from being very early preterm, who never get to someone like you or me, or the education of it. It's not just their prematurity. Maybe there's something else going on.
There's a lot. But so, you know, the other thing too is I expect a lot of these kids that were in the NICU for a while to have some skull asymmetry, like brachiocephaly and plagiocephaly. And some kids are horrible with it. And other kids, they're on that certain pillow where they have a nice rounded head. So it varies. And and if their head shape is off, of course, their mouth's going to be off too. And it may not be the ties. It may just be because they need some other type of work done.
Right. And they need lots of closeness with their mamas because they missed out on that.
Yeah.
And they need to heal and regulate with their mama. Like, that's what I always like to suggest is, you know, spend some time like acting like this baby when it comes back from NICU. Act like you would have when the baby was just born, you know. You'd be home, you'd be laying around, you'd be doing lots of skin to skin. Even though the baby is now 3 months old, it doesn't matter. You want to reacclimate to that.
They missed all that. Yeah. They were in a bed and under the lights for 3 months.
Yeah. But thank goodness we have that, right? I'm not trying to say anything negative about NICU in general.
No, NICU's all good. Do things in the proper sequence. And NICU's more important than anything we can do if you need to have a healthy baby. The first thing I said to that mother with the baby's history, I go, congratulations. They go, for what? They said, you know, you just went through a lot of stuff. You got a healthy baby. You know, now we'll take care of the rest of the stuff if you have anything. And I told her, I don't know for sure what you have. First, I had to do the exam and take photographs and show them what was what. But, you know, you want to make the parents feel good. That's part of the game, too. Well, it's not the game. It's the right thing to do.
Right. It's what we do if we're good providers. So before we sign off, Dr. Kaplan, I just want to, you know, in your bio mention ballroom dancing. And to me, you know, I don't want to just go through that quickly. I want to just say to you or ask you, what about ballroom dancing and being a dentist? What's the connection there? Anything? Like, do you take one? Does one help you with the other?
Well, I'm learning better music. And now when I'm treating the kids, I'm playing a lot of Winnie the Pooh music. And I'm playing different types of songs. And I play a lot of tango music for some of the babies. And the older kids, I play rap music. So I guess that would help.
Okay.
But I'm also, being in martial arts, you know, everything's kind of like really regimented, really stiff. And I actually a business and a life coach suggested that I try ballroom dancing to go out. I'm also single, so she wanted me to go out and meet people. But I really enjoyed the mechanics. And it's such a nice group of people that everybody is very, very supportive. And I'm having a blast now. And I actually do competitive dancing for my age group. And with my new grandson, I'm going to be doing a solo dance. And I'm going to dress in a Winnie the Pooh outfit with my dance instructor. And we're going to be doing something in front of about 300 people in Florida in September.
Oh, that's so exciting. Fun.
So that'll be fun.
So that's a contrast to the rigidness of karate, right? It's like
Well, karate gets you away from all the work stuff.
Right,
And then also karate and the other, actually ballroom dancing helps karate because now I have better balance and if I'm spinning and doing certain things and it's just all a lot better. And also gets you out of work. You got to do something different.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Marty, Dr. Kaplan, it was a pleasure to spend time with you today. I am sure that my audience has learned something from you and, We'll try to follow you. Are you on social media at all? I know you're on Facebook, right? Can they find you there?
I'm on Facebook. I don't see too much in social media because there's so much controversy that are unnecessary and people are I don't know if I'm using the word woke is right, but there's too much negativity. And if someone has a question for me, they can direct message me. I give out my phone number to everybody. Every patient of mine that needs me, you know, gets my number. They can text me, ask me questions, and I get back to them.
So do you have a practice website?
I'm in Hanover Pediatric Dentistry in Hanover, Mass, and they could look me up in Hanover.
Okay.
And
I'll put the contact info in the show notes.
You can even put my email on too. And if someone wants to get in touch with me by email, they can email me and then I'll get back to them and figure something out if they have some questions.
Excellent. Especially if you're in the Massachusetts area, right?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Kaplan. Have a great day.
You also. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of the Tongue Tie Experts podcast. Check out the show notes for useful links about the topics we discussed and for ways to follow us on social media. Please subscribe to us on your favorite podcast app. And if you enjoyed listening, we'd love it if you'd rate, review, and share with your friends and colleagues. Thanks so much. Bye-bye. Are you a healthcare professional working with breastfeeding infants? Wish you knew more about assessing and treating tongue ties? Earn continuing education credits and transform your practice with the Professional's Guide to Tongue Tie in the Breastfeeding Infant. It's perfect for any practitioner who works with infants and their mothers, especially those working through feeding challenges. Learn to identify who needs treatment, build a qualified care team, and provide holistic care options. Discover the ins and outs of phrenotomy, including procedure preparation and best aftercare practices. By the end, you'll be confidently supporting breastfeeding families armed with the latest protocols and be part of an interdisciplinary community of experts just like you. Tongue ties are nothing new, but the right way to assess and treat them is. Ready to make a real difference? Join now and become a tongue tie expert. Sign up today at tonguetieexperts.net/professional and become the evidence-based resource that your community needs. To show my gratitude, I'm offering you a special discount as a podcast listener. Use code PODCAST40 to save 40% off today.